that we'll work with for today's meeting? Okay. Seeing that, let's look for the minutes of our September 21st meeting. I'm looking at the minute packet here of the September 7th and ask if there's a motion or any comments about the minutes.
Move approval of minutes.
Been moved for approval. Is there a second? There is
second.
A second. Thank you. All right. Everyone in favor, which they are, so the minutes have been approved. Thank you very much. Let's go to the action items. The first action item is the system safety policy statements.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chairman, other members of the board. The first action item before you this morning is to approve the amendment to the LaMotta Board System Safety Policy Statement. This is represents the fourth revision. It was first done 1983, subsequently in 87 and 97, and now in 2006. Basically, our System Safety Program Plan is our apple pie, motherhood and apple pie document on how we manage safety here at Metro. And there are five minor revisions to this year's revision, which we're looking for approval. As an opportunity to really, to this amendment reaffirms the board's commitment to safety for our passengers and our employees and our contractors and the public at large. So with that, I would request that we move this forward for approval to the, by the board. There
Thank
is no
you.
Funding impact.
Any comments, questions? I don't see any. Like, is there a motion?
Move approval,
I move.
Mr. Chairman.
Second.
A second. Any discussion at all? Okay, no discussion. I see it looks like approved unanimously. Can I have all in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, thank you very much. We can move on to information items, the safety annual report.
Yes, sir. Our first information item is on the annual FY06 rail safety performance indicators. I'll be covering basically four major areas this morning briefly. They'll include rail operations, bus operations, metro access, and our risk data. We turn to the first chart. We'll see the rail safety performance indicators overall are pretty favorable. Injuries on passenger safety was de minimis at best. The biggest area I want to point out is that escalator injuries are down and going in the right direction. They have been really number one on our leaderboard for years, continue to be our number one on the leaderboard in terms of the passenger injuries in our stations. And we continue, we look at those accidents, each and every one of them, and 90%, or actually closer to 98% of them, have to do with not the electrical mechanical malfunction of an escalator, but human behavior, the use or misuse of an escalator. But doesn't mean that we just pull back and say, well, you know, it's up to our customers to use them properly. We are, you know, we've been and continue to focus on educating our passengers on how to use escalators safely. And we capitalize every year, well, twice a year, usually during the tourist season, before the commencement of tourist season in the spring. But November 13 marks the annual elevator escalator safety week. So we capitalize on that, and we hit the high-volume stations like Woodley Park Zoo, Smithsonian, and a lot of the other high-volume stations, and promote escalator and elevator safety with a specific hyper-focus on escalator safety. Pleased to report no collisions last year, and also no derailments, revenue service derailments, fire
Mr.
smoke
Chairman,
injuries.
Before we get on to that, since you're our safety guy, Fred, I noticed that we only light up our escalators every other light. Speaking in the safety realm, would it be helpful to have the escalators fully lit?
I can't speak to the illumination, but the lighting does help, and it has proven to eliminate trip fall accidents, and it's more important to have them at the ends where you board an escalator and where you alight an escalator. Mr. LaCrosse could probably address the
lighting. He'll be up here later to talk to you about escalators. So
okay.
I
just think, you know, I don't know what the cost would be. I can't imagine it would be astronomical to light the whole escalator up.
Right.
And it might keep people from tripping or falling and, you know.
Yeah. We've actually been out in the stations and we observe passenger behavior on escalators. And a lot of it is rushing down an escalator. We do encourage people to stand to the right. We don't encourage people to walk or run in escalators, that's for sure. But our the most vulnerable customers are the elderly and the young. And unfortunately, if they're in the way and people are rushing down for a train, they get plowed in the process, and that's our biggest concern and has been. Also, during the holiday seasons, a lot more people carrying baggage, parcels, bulk packages, and trip and falls, too. So we're pretty, you know, we have focused fairly closely on the human behavior, human factors when it comes to escalator usage, and it's been consistent. And that's not just here. That's in Boston or some of these other places that have a large number of escalators as well. We have the largest number of escalators anywhere in the world. Used to be Russia and London, but we have the dubious honor of having the largest number of escalators and some of the deepest as well.
Could I expand on something, just and not to in any ways minimize this data, but you need to look at the incident rate and think about what those rates mean. With the rail transit facility occupant injuries at 1.1, it's a decrease. It represents a substantial decrease, but you're talking about over 208, close to 210 million individual trips taken last year, 210 million individual trips last year. And during that time, we had 229 people who suffered some kind of injury in the facility. And if you look at those rates per million passenger mile and per million passengers, they're really quite astounding. That you have to, you have three injuries per 100 million passenger miles in fiscal year 2006. So we're talking about very small numbers. And when you make even small changes to small numbers, you get high percentage swings. But the fact is, I mean, I think this data really shows how incredibly safe the system is and how incredibly hard everyone works to keep people safe in the system. It's probably safer to be in the system than almost anywhere else.
Well, the good news is it's safe, and the good news is there's actually more escalators in use today than there were a year ago. The number's going down. The bad news is, which we're going to get to later, we still have to make sure the escalators are all working. So this is the one probably good news about escalators. Did you have any other questions?
No.
Thank you.
Okay.
And we have also...
yes? Excuse me.
Yes, sir.
Fred, I'm going back to the escalator injuries, and I think the information that you provided was very illuminating because, you know, before we prescribe solutions, I think it's very important to look at the nature of those injuries, and it seems to me that a significant number of those relate to people rushing to the train. I think we're trying to get some more information up at the top of the stations. There's some things like that that are being proposed. We don't know what that's going to do in terms of changing human behavior, because I think that when people see that information, they're still going to rush, because now they know the train may be arriving 1 second and it's downstairs, and I'm going to try to see if I can make it. So it'll be interesting to see what, you know, those solutions do to the escalator injury situation as we have it now.
Mm-hmm.
The analysis of that goes under the hood that you just provided in terms of the nature of those injuries is very helpful.
Well, it's interesting because you go take Wheaton Station, for example. It takes 3 minutes to ride from top to bottom if you were to just stand there and write it down. And if you forgot something in your car, you go back up, it's another 3 minutes. So you're talking 10 minutes if you go make that trip, round trip. So and people aren't that patient to wait it out 3 minutes to ride down to the bottom of the escalator. Some of them you can't see the light at the end of the tunnel. It looks pretty far up and pretty far down. But we're going to continue to hammer on that program. And it's also important to note, too, as far as injuries go, there have been minor injuries. It wasn't the case 8 years ago. We had two fatalities. But we've equipped these escalators with a lot of safety devices that a lot of other transit properties don't. We improved the safety switches on the cone plates that trip out. And, yeah, it does cause inconvenience at times because it does knock out the escalator when that does happen. But we've increased those switches so to prevent. And since then, we haven't had a fatality on an escalator or major entrapment on an escalator. We've lost some sneakers, mm-hmm. but we haven't lost any feet.
Okay.
Fire, smoke, too. That was something years ago that we played with. Over, wasn't unusual to have 60 incidents a year that shut down service for quite some time. We had three last year. The nature of the fire was pretty de minimis in terms of the impact and damage on the system. But we really attribute that to the in-kind services provided primarily by Prince George's County by training all of our train operators on how to extinguish fires. In fact, most cases when there is a fire incident in our station, albeit they're usually trash fire or light ballast or track debris, the fire department enables our staff to put them out, our station officials and our transit officials. Whereas before, they used to shut down the system, wait for them to arrive, they would extinguish it, and then give it all clear. So it's the trust that we have. We do a lot of training with them over the Carmen Turner facility in Landover. Right. So the quid pro quo has been that we train them, and in turn they give us training in fire extinguisher training. Yeah. That's paid off in dividends in terms of service disruption, minimal.
Okay, and is this for all jurisdictions, or are you singling out Prince George's County? But
well, they volunteer to actually conduct the training
okay.
for us. So.
Got you.
Okay. If we turn our attention to the rail performance in terms of station overruns, they're down considerably. We can approve that. You know, we have imposed a management oversight, rule enforcement, and disciplinary action as well. We also have run a lot more in manual mode operation as well. So the trade-off is you'll see a rise in red signal violations because the operators are actually operating, driving the trains, and not an ATO operation. So we are addressing that as a separate item. But the door incidents and the station overruns are down. But you know, our chief of rail operation did impose more manual mode operations during the rush hour periods, and that has helped considerably. There is new software going into the 2000, 3000, the 5000 series car, which is promising and showing a reduction. We hope that will correct the problem through a software change that's going on right now. But right now, it seems that the enforcement of the rules and governing them coming into the station, as well as operating more in manual mode than ATO, has made a considerable impact. We change modes now to the bus safety performance indicators. Slight increase, but again, if you have, like Mr. Tangler, you said, if you look at the incident rate, it's pretty de minimis in terms of the increases in the variance. Bus collisions are down. Our biggest challenge, and will continue to be a challenge, not just for us, but in the metropolitan region, was reported in the Washington Post several months ago that pedestrian accidents were capped out at 3,000 last year. And we're part of that metropolitan region, operating our buses in this metropolitan region. We've had our share in pedestrian accidents, and it's a two-way street. We need to work with pedestrians as well as with our operators in controlling these numbers. And we have many initiatives in place with DDOT. We're working with various groups. We're working on engineering controls, education, and enforcement. So it's a three-prong approach. In terms of the metro access, the story isn't a good story. It'll see a significant jump in metro access collisions. One reason is because they were under-reporting last year, and now they're reporting everything. So once you start reporting everything, you're going to see a spike in those numbers. Also, they had a considerable, I don't have the number, but they had a considerable turnover rate last year as well. They're embarking on a more objective Smith system, which is a training system for to plan on training all of their operators by January 07. We've been working with them as well. We've had an assessment of where the gaps are in their performance and working with them to bring them up to we consider an acceptable level. But right now, the numbers don't look good. But if we squint into the first, quarter of FY07, their preventable accidents have already going down. So they have made some management changes, and they've put in some new managers, and it seems to be turning the corner in terms of the performance. So again, after December or January, we'll see if the efficacy of those initiatives have.
So Fred, then with the reporting, you're saying that if you're under reporting, you might not have done as much training. So maybe this is a blessing that we're getting the right reports. We know where the problems are, and the system is improving.
Yes, sir. And also the onboard recorders too are helping as well, as far as target some of the areas they're having, whether they're in reverse mode or taking right-hand turns or whatever. So,
okay.
But it has shown a problem, deficiency in the training, and that's they've beefed up.
And Steve Yaffe is here to talk about it a little more, but the actual number of FTA reportable incidents, the incidents that have a certain threshold, has actually gone down from year to year. So while the overall number of accidents have gone up, reportable accidents, the severe accidents, from what I understand from Steve, has actually gone
right.
down.
Right.
And so this may be more of an artifact of the fact that there's just better reporting, higher quality reporting, more consistent reporting of overall accidents.
Just a clarity on the under-reporting then. Let's go back to what we base our change on. And you said there was the under-reporting. Is the under-reporting based upon some system that we had devised or simply X number of trips and X number of accidents that were reported versus where we're going now? Do we have something that I would call it auditable in terms of setting the milestones that you want and what you receive back? What was our original process for reporting,
well,
allow under-reporting?
Well, the under-reporting, as it was reported, according to my investigators, were that they were using the FTA threshold, which is usually a monetary damage threshold, and so we wanted to capture all accidents. And also came down to a definition of define the difference between an incident or a near miss versus an accident, which is actually results in injury or physical damage. So going through those definition of thresholds made a difference. So we capture everything, but like Mr. Tanglerini mentioned, that is the FTA thresholds as well, which will show a lower than the under their reporting system. But you know, we take every accident seriously. And if we get the small ones, we figure those small ones, we arrest those, we'll take care of the bigger ones. So it's really behavioral modification in terms of the operators driving these vehicles. And with the turnover rate so high, we make sure there's some stability in the rank and file as well.
In the training part, what is the process based upon accidents that you do as, say, are there triggers for retraining? Are there triggers for certain penalties?
Yeah, their training department has beefed up their training department, and they use technology, the camcorders, the recorders on board, and they pull those cameras randomly, and they look at those, and they look at the high-risk operators, people who have probably had accidents in the past, see if they can find any behavioral changes that are required, and bring them in for retraining. But we already know that their training is deficient, has been, so they are going with a new system, and they have promised to retrain, recertify all their operators by the first of the year. So Mr. Yaffe perhaps could talk a little more on that when he's up here.
Yes.
Language is so important when you talk about things like this, and I'm not sure under-reporting really reflects where we are. It sounds to me that we operated with two different standards, that there was the industry standard required by FTA, which is the standard that we were reporting on, and it seems to me now that you have adopted to go beyond that standard to reflect incidents that were not reported before. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. For a fender bender, like you break a mirror on the vehicle because you sideswiped a tree or a shrub or a mailbox, may have gone unreported in the past because it didn't meet the FTA threshold. Reportable because of the dollar amount, but we're capturing everything now.
Because underreported sounds makes it appear as if you're hiding some data.
Absolutely.
And we don't want it to be reflected as that. It's not underreporting. It's the fact that there were different standards that were required. There's national standards that are promulgated by the FTA. We were complying with that, and our standards reflected that. But what we're doing now is going beyond that. There are other detailed accidents that are not required by the FTA that we're now reflecting in our report.
That's probably better stated, actually.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Dana. I think so.
one silly detailed question, then.
He
says that you'll calibrate the drive cam to the lowest setting. I guess I should be glad to hear that.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah, well, excuse that. They adjust the camera to pick up the motions of the operators as well as the braking. If you put a sudden brake application, it'll turn on. If the vehicle's going 30 miles an hour and you slam the brakes on, then the camera will trigger on.
Okay. So now that. Okay. I thought it was a steering mechanism.
No, it ties in with the braking.
Okay. All right.
Sorry, I should have explained.
That's okay. The other is in looking at perhaps why the reporting was underreported, was there any aspect of the bonus payment to the contractor tied to the number of accidents?
Good question. I can't answer that, but Mr. Yaffe may be able to.
On the Logisticare wasn't required to report everything. I'm not that familiar if they had a bonus payment for that or not in the old Logisticare contract. The MV contract right now has a bonus payment for not injuring too many people in a month, which I find it kind of depressing, to be honest. So we are talking with MV, and they've agreed that we really should have an accident-based standard. And when we come back with contract revisions, that'll be included.
Okay. The other thing is, in terms of the contract, in terms of the training, you know, as I recall, to be a paratransit operator, it's not a CDL license, it's a regular license, I believe. And I'm wondering, what is the training that our contractor requires of the men or women before they're physically
transporting our customers?
Well, MV is revamping the hiring process to make sure that they're getting the right people in. They've always had a review of their driving record and their police record, but there's different methodologies of doing that, and they have tightened that up. The training, they've changed the defensive driving course has changed. They're now using the Smith system, in which you're to be constantly aware of your surroundings, planning ahead 15 seconds, knowing what's behind you, looking always aware of if you need an escape route to the left or right, what that would be. It's a more thorough training. And as Mr. Gadeen mentioned, every driver, whether they work for MV or work for another subcontractor, will be trained in this starting this month and by the end of the year.
And the new hires, are they trained in that before they're strapping our customers in?
New hires that go through it, yes, okay. Absolutely.
And the final one would be just how does that training as it's now being effectuated compared to, if there's such thing as an industry standard, is it, are we at the norm, above the norm?
I don't know of a system as good as, well, I don't want to do a commercial for them. Mm-hmm. I don't know that Smith is the norm yet, but so I would say that the Smith system is probably above the norm.
Okay.
In paratransit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Kathy, I think you had a comment.
No.
Mr. Deegan, you had something?
Yeah. Before we let you go, Fred, I just wanted to, what was it, a week ago, 2 weeks ago, the chairman and I were lucky enough to visit the rodeo and that CERT recertification. It was at Pensy Drive. And I don't think we pay enough attention to the job you do in organizing that CERT retraining. I know Prince George, appreciate your comments from Prince George's County. Their director of Homeland Security actually invited me there that day, and I was glad to attend, as I'm sure Mr. Briscusa was. And I think those efforts go a long way for producing the kind of report that you're highlighting here today in reducing our accidents, particularly the rodeo operation as well as the CERT. So I just wanted to commend you for that and say keep up the good work there.
Well, thank you, sir. It's a joint effort with Paulie Hanson and myself, so thank you. Two areas we added this time for the year end are the risk indicators. Spending a lot more time focusing on our risk, where we're most vulnerable in terms of our reserves on both workers' compensation and third-party claims. And the first thing I want to talk about are the indicators of third-party claims. Overall, they're actually going in the right direction. The average claim cost just went up a little bit, but the bodily injury claims went down significantly, as well as the cost of the damage claims. One thing we've really been aggressive is pursuing subrogation, you know, the monies that we're entitled to, and you can see that's going up, and our goal is to hit close to $1 million this year in recovering those funds. as far as the workers' compensation, you know, overall it's good, but, I'm reluctant to say that only because it's overshadowed by the death of two employees last year, the tragic loss of October of 2005. And again, in May of 06, tragically lost a two of our track employees. And, you know, it does little to console people when you say if we're doing really well in some areas. And it's, like I said, it's overshadowed by those losses. And I'd really not let the record speak for itself.
Help me on repeaters. What exactly are repeaters?
Good question. I'm glad you asked. We find that 30% of our work is comp every year. People have been out before, repeaters. And if you take 1,000 claims, you know, 300 of those have been out before. And we're focusing, hyper-focusing on that group. But why are they continually going out? And we've been focusing on that through retraining. Before, they would be allowed to go right back into the workplace without any check-in. Now they have to go to the manager of safety training. They have to be retrained before they go back into the workplace. And then they meet with their supervisor at the workplace and say, okay, we're introducing this employee back into the workplace. And we want to ensure that you as a supervisor ensuring a safe workplace, and this person's been recertified or whatever, retrained in forklift training, whatever may have been the cause of that accident or injury. And also, we've beefed up a modified work program. So we're not the distance center, bringing people back to work. They may be 70% able, but as far as we're concerned, that's good enough. We'll find a job for them or bring them back rather than have them sit home and watch Dr. Phil all day.
Okay.
So we're bringing them back. Also, one thing we kicked off this month was a joint Labor Management Safety Council, so it's a historic moment for us here at Metro. It's the first time that the leadership of the unions and management are now working together and addressing safety in the workplace. So that we formed this this month. So, and the last one is our annual report on the occupational and the construction safety. This is the first time that I'm happy to report that actually overall, the OSHA reportable injuries were actually below the national average for the industry, 8.7 versus 9.4. Our construction industries, again, well below the national average of 2.1 at 0.8. And that's all I have to say today.
That's great. Any of my colleagues have any questions? No. Okay. I want to thank you. And, Paul, I know in your interest in getting us the most recent information, you wanted to make a statement or clarification.
I did. When we sent you the packet, the information that we had available was the August information. So there is this loose sheet underneath your packet. I thought it would be more appropriate to talk about the most current crime information, which Monday, the September information was available. So everybody does have one of these. The month of September, total Part 1 crime, which is a serious crime, was down 33% compared to the same time last year. There was a decrease in auto theft, down from 8 incidents from 21 to 13. Attempt stolen autos are down by 14, with 19 reported in 05 and 5 in 06. Theft from autos are up from 12 offenses last September to 20 this reporting period. The aggravated assaults for the month are down from 9 last year to 7 this September, though aggravated assaults do average between 7 and 8 per month. Bike theft continue in an upward trend with an increase of just 1, but that's a pattern that we've been seeing. So this month was 21 last September. I'm sorry, last September was 21 and this September was 22. Pickpockets are down from 7 to 3. The stealthy pickpockets are down from 5 last September to 3 this year. There was a significant decrease in robbery force crimes from 34 last year to 11 this September. And the breakdown was 6 force and violent, 4 armed, and 1 fear, which is, I'm just inferring that that I'm going to do something to you when I rob you. All robberies combined are down 33, with 46 reported last September and 17 this. Bus crime is down for the second month in a row, and we're very pleased with that because you're well aware that bus crime had been increasing. And in some of the same ways that Fred alluded to about better reporting several years ago, we really made an effort to get out to bus drivers and encourage them to report crimes and created mechanisms that they might not have had available previously so that they could. And so as a result, we saw an increase in those reported crimes. And as a result of other efforts that we've been doing where we touch base with bus operators every day trying to get a feel for timely where the crime's occurring. During August and September, there were very concerted efforts to respond to those places and increase enforcement, and we believe that that's paid off in a decrease in crime by 8 offenses, with 8 this September compared to 16 last September, a decrease of 50%. Bus crimes per million are down 51% this month. So the rail crimes per million are down 25%, reflecting a decrease in all the robberies, and then parking lot crimes are showing a 31% decrease for this September. The majority of rail and bus Part 2 crimes are simple assaults, destruction of properties, which can be shattered car windows or juveniles throwing missiles and breaking bus windows. When we write alcohol violations and other citations that we issue as well. Overall, though, year-to-date, crime is up 4%. And we did see a trend starting in June where crime started to increase June, July, with a high of 11% in August, and now it's at 4% in September. That does track with a national trend. I know that there have been reports in the media nationally. Police chiefs are experiencing an increase in crime and robberies and assaults, and we've seen that in this region as well. What we've tried to do is really, from myself down to the most junior police officer, draw attention in our patrol division to where the crime is. We've tried to increase visibility, and as a result of increased visibility, we've seen an increase in enforcement activities, which have been arrests and citations issued. And those increases, we believe, have contributed to the decrease that we've seen in September, and we would hope to see that trend in October as well. October is Crime Prevention Month. We have a variety of activities in the system. There's a table outside today with all sorts of crime prevention information. It illustrates the type of information we're sharing with our customers. We're doing auto theft dialogue, talking about layered protection with etching or having systems in place, steering column locks, as well as alarms, talking about people not leaving valuables in their vehicles because we are seeing the increase in larcenies from vehicles. Pickpocketing, we always do a seminar and a demonstration on that, and certainly outreach with our employees as well.
Okay. Other questions? Yes, Gladys.
I just would like to hear a little bit more about the parking lots. It seems that we've got a lot of activity there. It's up over the this month last year, and it's also up considerably for the year. So what are we doing to try to stay that statistic?
Well, the Part 1 crime month-to-month comparison, it's down 31%. Year-to-date, it's up 6.5%.
I'm looking at Part 2.
Okay, Part two increases are not always a bad thing because Part 2 crimes sometimes are self-initiated by police officers. So Part 2 crime can be the issuance of citations for things like urinating in public or drinking or vending violations. For instance, in Prince George's County, operator of a taxi could receive a ticket if he or she is not in possession of the appropriate paperwork. So the Part 2 is not always a bad increase because those do reflect enforcement activities that are self-initiated.
Okay, so there's nothing in particular that you see in parking lots that we need to pay more attention
the
to?
The theft from the autos, certainly the larcenies that we're experiencing, is a concern. And certainly at this time of year, we do a variety of activities. One is that our midnight crew goes out in the beginning of October every year and reports to maintenance all the lights that are out in both our parking lots and on our station platforms. We like to encourage that the lights be replaced before the time change because it gets darker earlier, and then people start getting ready for the holidays. They'll have more packages in their vehicles. They're more distracted. They have more money on them. So we really use October as an opportunity to have conversations about not leaving things in your vehicle and then making sure that our environment is the best that it can be to prevent crime, making sure that our bushes are cut, that our fences are repaired, and once again, that our lighting is the best that it can be.
Okay, thank you.
Gordon.
Chief, one of the things I was just listening to your comments about, responding to Chairwoman Gladys's comments or question is whether, and I don't want to give you any more work because you have enough to do as it is, whether or not there be a reporting way that would better reflect what you just suggested.
Absolutely.
You'd like to see the Part 2 broken down as to what's enforcement and what's reported crime?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
okay.
That might be helpful to capture that information because you're right, as you explained it, enforcement is good data to collect, and we know that you're actually, that shows an increase in taking care of matters that are occurring on a lot versus injuries to employees, injuries to customers, or crimes that make take place against the individual. So that would be helpful.
And we could include a supplemental page. And I would like to note that we took advantage of the intern program this summer, and we got a IT-savvy college intern who spent the summer updating and renewing our website. And so if you have an opportunity to go on the Metro website and go into the part that is the Metro Transit Police, it's really robust and I think fabulous. And it shares far more information, ways to contact us, ways our customers can file a complaint or make a commendation, a lot more crime prevention information, and all sorts of links to other police departments and other resources, and it just really looks fabulous.
Chief, not another page, just a breakout.
That's a great
I like the way it's here.
Okay.
I don't know the page is so pretty.
I just know that I'm wearing these glasses now, and it would have to be so small that you wouldn't be able to read it.
That's okay.
We'll put it on the back.
Okay. Mr. Deegan, you had a comment.
Thank you, Ray. You know, with the tag on to what Gladys said about the reporting, you know, I know because you've given it to me in the past, the statistics based on station location for, like, stolen vehicles and stuff like that. Might be helpful if we get that once a year as well. I know my jurisdiction's interested in seeing that. But one thing you said today, that we go out in October and we send, you have officers go out in October and you check for lights that are out and bushes that need shrubs. Mr. Tangarini, do we really need to have a police officer do that?
Actually, you don't necessarily have to use a police officer to do that. But if a police officer is out there, why not use their presence throughout the system to report back? What we'd like is everyone who's a part of the Metro system, even riders, to report examples of where lights out. The idea is to make it a responsibility of all employees to be committed to the system and committed to getting the improvements. But then also, you know, a particular interest in getting police officers to reflect their personal responsibility and their interest in seeing these crime prevention tools fully deployed. I think the chief actually can speak most eloquently.
Well, it was a fact you made it sound like you do this exactly in October.
We do because of the time change, and we want to make sure that we're providing the best environment. That's not to suggest that other employees don't do it the other 11 months out of the year or that our own cops don't do it every day. But in October, as a part of a contribution that Midnights can make because they're out there, and we want all our officers every day to be involved in crime prevention through environmental design because the system was designed that way. So we use this opportunity to remind everybody that that's what we should be doing.
My concern is that that wasn't all they were doing.
Oh, no.
October,
right? Oh, no.
And now I have to ask the question I always ask. What's our current vacancy rate on police officers?
Well, I've not looked at the daily report today. I can tell you that we've got a class in January that we're hiring for.
I ask you that every time I see you.
I know, and it's usually, 20, and of course it's been as high as 40 after the beginning of the fiscal year because the board was kind enough to give us the additional positions for the bus enforcement squad. But I can tell you every day there's a new face up there, so I'm not sure what the figure is today. But we've got a class in January, and we hope to have in excess of 20 bodies in it.
Good. Thank you.
Yes, Dana.
Looking at the footnote, I guess, on the report, Chief, that this does reflect just our reports. Between now and when this comes to the full board, if you could augment this to include the other local jurisdictional police departments, because again, we are trying to capture what we as policymakers should be concerned about taking place on our property.
And that actually was page 31, and that only was January to August. The September data is still coming in, so we didn't want to give you information that was incomplete for the reports by other police departments. Sometimes we don't, we're really good about sharing our information. We walk ours over to D.C. almost every day, but some of the other reports are a little slower coming in.
Then if I was to take what's on this page and pair that with the crime report, does that in any way modify the trends, accentuate the trends?
Well, once again, you see, the increases in aggravated assaults and in robberies, the theft from autos, and of course the stolen bicycles, which I mentioned, which is a concern of mine. And some people would tell you it's petty, but I'm concerned about our customers that bring their very expensive bikes and then come back and they're not there. So we're really puzzled about who it is that are stealing those. So I'm really kind of taking it so personal that I'm willing to go out in casual clothes and sit at one of the stations. But I think the tracking as far as trending about what crimes are increasing are in line with the types of crimes that we're experiencing ourselves.
Okay, because that's one of the things that obviously we reflect the neighborhoods we serve. And I think that needs to be as well captured as we can, since it's not, again, in terms of the number of incidents taking place at Metro versus in other parts adjoining communities, we've always seemed to have found that the neighborhoods frankly safer in Metro than you are in your own neighborhood sometimes. So we need to keep showing that so that we can be assured that that's still the trend.
Yes, and I think we've had great success with auto theft reductions that other parts of the region are not experiencing. Okay. So
thank you.
Thank you, Chief Hans. I don't see any other comments, so we can move on to the escalators.
If I can, Mr. Chairman, just do a couple-minute introduction. Mr. LaCoste is going to go bring you through the next information item. It is on an analysis that we've done inside about converting a selected number of our escalators to stairs. This is an item that came up a couple of committee meetings ago, 3-4 months ago, asking us what would we look into this, what would be the analysis cost to removing some of the escalators, putting in stairs, where would we look at doing it, where would we not, and then bring it back to the board for some input, some reflection from you before we did it any further. And there's some next steps about talking to the public and all that. So this is just a preliminary analysis that Mr. Lacoste is going to bring you through. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dave, all yours.
Good morning. As Mr. Hughes said, this is a preliminary analysis in response to a request from the board a few months back to study how feasible it would be to convert some escalators to stairs with the interest in saving future operating costs. Part of the analysis, it was considered we did not want to look at any escalator that was over 30 feet high. We also gave serious consideration to the disabled community. I did not want to consider any escalators that would eliminate a mechanized means to move people up and down. So in every situation here, there is still escalators available to take someone up and take someone down. Out of our 88 stations, we came up with 23 escalators in 18 stations, and in 15 stations. And if all 23 of those escalators were to be converted, it would cost us approximately $14 million to do that. But in the end, we would save roughly $4.5 million by not having to rehabilitate 18 of those escalators, and we could potentially save about $1.2 million a year in operating costs, which could be reprogrammed for other elevator escalator projects or other things. In terms of funding impact, right now there is no funding for this program. If the board was to consider this, we would need to develop a funding plan, and also the next steps would be to seek public input from the Ridership Advisory Council, the Elderly and Disabled Committee, and perhaps some other public forums.
Mr. Deegan, go to the next slide. We specifically identify.
I'm sorry.
I'm going to get you answer specifically your question, I guess. But we went through each of the stations based on the criteria that Mr. LaCoste laid out there, and we gave to you the candidates, the 23 escalators that are out there, and reemphasized something that a couple of points that Mr. LaCoste made. And that is, these are not our long escalators. They are the shorter escalators. Every one of these locations, there is a redundancy, whether it's a Farragut North, where there are three escalators there side by side, and we could pull one out. The concept is to pull one out, keep two of them operating, and make the center one is stairs. Or Crystal City, where there's three of them in parallel, you could do the same type of thing. So the concept is, by removing escalators, there is still the vertical transportation, both escalators and elevators going up and down at every station, plus the availability of having stairs. And it's a comment we've heard from time to time from our customers and from some selected board members that says, do we need as many escalators? They are very expensive to maintain. Are there places like we already have at Union Station and selected other locations where we can have stairs to give our customers an option as to what they want to do? And so it's not all over the place where we can do that. There are a selected number of this. There may be some long-term savings from this. We might be able to convert that long-term operating savings into the capital to make this happen, or the long-term savings into a capital to do something else that we're looking to do. For example, putting in redundant elevators at our transfer locations, which is something our E&D committee is asking us to move forward in a capital program that's not funded. But before we move forward with how that would go, what are the pros and cons, what are the funding mechanisms where we go, we were trying to get some feedback for you, so I apologize for that.
I'd just like to add one more thing, that this represents a less than 5% reduction in the number of escalators within the system. It's a very conservative approach to it, and yet the savings generated from just the annual operating cost reductions would probably be sufficient to finance the improvement alone if we were to use our current cost of borrowing. So that it's an interesting idea that's being, it's just part of a broader set of questions of why do we have certain things that we have in Metro, and are there different ways that we can do things, and would it have cost implications, and maybe improve service at one level, allow us to focus on maybe some of the more difficult challenges like the longer escalators, which you could never remove, take those resources and dedicate them to keeping a smaller population running more consistently.
My turn now.
Yes, sir.
Maybe we can answer the question with the lights on the escalators first. Why we only have half the lights lit?
The reason I believe that we only have half the lights lit on the escalators, I believe it's a power issue. Right now, there are lights there on most of the escalator balustrades that could be lit, but I believe that the amount of the circuit breakers in the panels are set at, I'm just going to say, 15 amps, and if we hooked up all of the lights on the longer escalators, we would exceed the capacity of that circuit, which I know I've been asking the same question for a couple of years now, and so that's about as close as I can get to an answer.
Is this a matter of changing a circuit breaker?
Yes.
Maybe we could look into doing that. I think it would go a long way. You know, Mr. Zimmerman, I'm sorry he's not here today, talking about brightening up our stations, we could start with the escalators. And I think, you know, when Mr. Gordine earlier said, you know, you put more light on it, it's got to maybe help the accident ratio.
I
now, being one that I'd like to think I'm here for our customers and customer service, and therefore I'm not too thrilled about doing away with any escalators. And also representing the larger section of the community that is not petite and tiny, you know, we like riding escalators.
Maybe exercise would help. My wife's a wellness coach. Maybe exercise would help. But yeah.
there's no doubt about that, Mr. Litton. But now trying to take an objective look at this, I got a few questions for you. The average conversion cost is like $604,000, right? What's the range between like a 10-foot escalator versus the 27.5-foot escalator? I mean, did we break that down, or is it?
I don't.
Still the $604,000, regardless of what you do.
These are rough estimates. I mean, obviously, it would cost more to do a 24-foot escalator than a 10.5-foot escalator. I can get those numbers, you know, boil them out further. I don't have them available right now.
Okay. Well, here's something we do. We rehab these escalators. is there a difference in cost and how long the escalator is on the rehab, or is it always $250,000?
No, again, the $250,000 is an average.
Okay. Now, the other question I have, would it make better sense just to focus on this list of the ones that are scheduled for rehab?
Well, there is the ones that are scheduled for rehab, we would realize, you know, additional savings by not having to spend the rehab money. Yes.
18 of them on that list are scheduled for rehab.
18. Well, I'm personally very happy that only two of these are in Maryland. I try to read this reading.
Oh, yeah, that's right. How many of them?
One of my colleagues argue with their.
Now, remember, Mr. Deegan, part of the focus of the study was not to remove all the up and down escalators, so there'd still be one available for you to go up and one available for you to go down.
The question is, are there multiple escalators that go up and down? Are there multiple escalators that go over small periods, small spaces? And as a result, we have a higher incidence then of those escalators being unavailable. We have a higher number of escalators we have to take care of and a lower likelihood or a higher investment necessary to try to keep them all running at the same time. Is it possible, like at Union Station, our busiest station in the system, to have on the south entrance, like we have, one side has escalators going up and down, and one side has one escalator and one staircase? And, you know, it serves the most number of customers in the system, and we have three escalators to maintain rather than four. That saves us money, it provides us the same service, and provides options to the riders.
I understand that, but I was also wondering, maybe we could kind of reduce the scope of this idea to maybe escalators under 20 feet. You know, could you talk in almost, 27 and a half feet? 27 and a half feet on that, and, you know, that's like three stories.
Right, but those would only be in cases where there are existing redundant escalators. So in places where we have three escalators, you would have two escalators and a stair. Gallery Place is an example where you have, in this instance, three escalators and a long staircase. And that staircase, I'm sorry?
Four escalators and a long staircase.
Four escalators and a long staircase. And people use the staircase.
Well, funny you should mention Gallery Place, because I got off of that station this morning. And like I do most days. And I sat there and I watched the people going on the first escalator, because it's got a staircase right next to it. There was one person that took the stairs. Everybody else, and the number got to where I couldn't count, rode that escalator. And then I went up after the trains left. So I think our customers like riding these escalators. And they're used to it. And to take it away to save $1.2 million, I'm not sure is wise for this agency. That's just me, but you know, I'm open-minded to look at it.
Yeah, that's $1.2 million a year in perpetuity. It's less than 5% of the escalators. It's places where there are redundant escalators. The question is, could that money then be driven into a long-term investment in additional rail cars, which our customers like?
We could buy half
additional
a rail
lighting.
Car,
huh? You could buy about a rail car a year, yeah. And then you also eliminate the future, the going forward rehabilitation costs, reduce the number of escalators you have to deal with, reduce the amount of parts. I think that there are probably longer term and more substantial savings that are yielded here, other than the health effects that Mr. Linton
has. Yeah, well, I appreciate the health effects. And like I say, I'm trying to keep an open mind here, but you know, right. It's certainly obviously not one of my top priorities on where to invest more money in.
This is going to be a very interesting topic. I think we have Gladys, then Dana, then Kathy that wanted to make comments, and then Gordon.
Gordon's going to give me a personal training.
Charlie, I just want to observe that 10 of these are in the district, so that's a concern also. My question has to do with the math. We say it costs roughly $14 million to convert these escalators to stairs, and we say $4.5 million of not having to rehabilitate 18 existing escalators, which leaves six, seven. Before we could recover before we could break even on this change? How long would it take to break even on making this change?
It's less than 10 years because $1.2 million works out to $12 million over 10 years plus 14.45, that'd be 16.5. You're looking at about 8 years to recover the cost.
8 years to recover the cost.
Right. And that doesn't include the fact that the rehabs take place every 10, 15, or 20 years, depending on the type of the rehab. We're assuming just general annual operating budget, not rehab and other repairs to the system. So 8 years you recover the cost, but it also ignores the longer-term annuity value of forever not having to pay $1.2 million and forever not having to rehab the escalator.
Right. I think on the numbers we could probably use a little bit more information on that.
Right.
The primary concern of this would be where we find the $14 million to do the initial investment, and there's always the competition for the capital dollars, so that's really...
But you could convert the annual operating savings into a debt service to actually pay... Mm-hmm. To pay back the capital costs associated.
You could. I mean, that's a possibility. And again, like all of this, you'd have to weigh it against other priorities. I think the message we want to give, because I've gotten at least some input from our riders who say, oh no, we don't want to do this. I think what we need to say now is that this is just a first look at what this change could mean, and that it is not in active consideration at this time. I think it's important for us to make that point clear.
But what is actively considered is the rehabilitation, the actual expenditure of the money to rehabilitate 18 of these 23 of these escalators. And the question is, at some point, are we going to make a decision to make that investment, $4.5 million? Thank you. It's right there. To make that investment of $4.5 million, if there's a possibility that by deferring that investment, we actually free up enough resources to convert these escalators and save the money.
I agree with that. Yes.
Okay. Before Dana was next, I have one question though, just technically. Are we comparing all the costs? I mean, I should ask Fred when he was here. There are no additional costs because of safety and injuries and claims, stairs versus escalators, or have those been captured in here? Are we only looking at the construction costs and the maintenance costs, and do we need to concern that? Or are stairs also more cost-effective because you get less falls?
You'll notice that there was no statistic on in the safety area on falls on stairs. The escalators is one of our areas of higher claim.
Okay, so you're saying there'd be additional savings.
I'm saying that hasn't been included in here.
That might be something we want to look at as we go forward. But Dana, you were next. I'm sorry.
You began by saying we asked for this. Is the board?
No. I asked for it. I asked the escalator folks to look at this question as we were pursuing. I'm sorry, and I didn't mean to in any way suggest, unless you're interested in, and I can tell from the comments you're not. I asked for it because it was part of a broader, when I said we, just as we were looking on this side of the table at various ways that we could save money, do things differently, and ask bigger questions that maybe haven't been asked in the 30 years of running the railroad. You know, why do we have the largest single fleet of escalators in the world? Why do we have more escalators than any other transit authority? Why do we have the second largest escalator after Moscow? Are there other ways, different ways that we could do our business and maybe a better, more efficient way?
You're right. The tone was we who Kimosabe.
Yeah. You mean we.
First, I just commend staff for once again asking hard questions. Mm-hmm. And in your brief tenure here, you brought us a lot of great ideas. I don't think this is one of them. my concern is looking at it on a number of levels, kind of a different way of what Charlie was saying. I haven't had anybody come up to me and saying, hey, I'd rather see a stair here. A couple other things, you know, clearing the speed of clearing the platform, looking at the demographics of our service population, you're looking at all of us grow older before you, Dan. You're still young, but we're growing older. So the senior population, the issue of, for years we've heard on the escalators that they need to be covered. I think most of the escalators on this list, if not all, are covered, if not interior. So one could say that we're ripping out the escalators that work. So we're also looking, frankly, you know, Vienna is an example. Yes, we want stairs. We recognize the value of stairs, but we're looking at adding stairs. So maybe the question the board would come back to staff is, you know, where are areas that we would benefit, where we should be adding stairs? I don't think from the focus of where we rip out escalators and replace them with stairs, but where we should be adding. Since moving people, clearing our busy platforms is one of the bigger safety issues we have that perhaps isn't captured in those statistics we just went over. So I appreciate the analysis that went into this, but in looking at that deep thought question, you know, I'm glad we're not getting lost in deep thought, finding a way into it, but I can't support this item as presented. I think we instead should be focusing on where we should be adding stairs with some of these capital dollars as opposed to replacing escalators with stairs.
And I guess the response to that is by doing this, we actually could be freeing up capital dollars that could make investments in needed staircases like the north entrance of Union Station. North, when people get off the MARC and VRE trains, which have seen double-digit increases in the last 5 years, they come down to one set of escalators, and they hope they're both working. The point is we do need more stairs throughout the systems. We do need more vertical transportation. The question is, are we making investments, continued investments in existing vertical transportation that may be redundant, that may be costly, that may not provide extra level of service, and then costs us precious dollars, precious capital dollars that can be invested?
I would just say again, though, if previous statistics are true, Dan, these are the ones that have been working.
Right.
But so the message we're sending is it's not cut and run, but it's a rip and remove.
but 18 of 23 of them, we're about to just completely rip down to studs and rebuild and make another 30-year investment in them. The question we asked was, before we do that, do we want to ask the question? Maybe people don't. I actually think it is a worthwhile exercise, and even if the answer is no.
I'm not faulting the exercise. Mm-hmm. I'm just not ready to go there.
Dana, thank you. Kathy, who's next, and then Gordon?
I'm going to be brief because I think the comments that I have been articulated in one way. I would just want to emphasize that in the growing system that we have, accessibility and increase in the population that will use it is very critical in what we consider. So as I looked at it, I immediately said, what does this make? Does this make our system much more inviting, more accessible? We look at a senior disabled population, and we're going out to those communities, so I would just welcome their input and understand how they see it. But it seems to me that it did not strike the primary focus that I think we should be on, and that is, are we making the system more accessible and to a larger population of people that sometimes find our system inviting?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Gordon, you're a patient. Thank you.
let me say, with my health jokes aside, I think that I applaud the analysis. I think we as a board ask the interim general manager to examine where, in fact, we can make effective investments, because we do have a lot of things in the system that we are trying to buy. And a lot of those things are things that customers have asked for. And in that light, you need to examine whether or not you're making the best use of the dollars in the investment. I think this analysis goes a long ways towards doing that. Obviously, there are places where we are going to need additional stairs. I think you have to look at issues such as where you're clearing the platform. But I do think this is an appropriate analysis. I for one, do not reject it out of hand. I do think it's a consideration that we need to make. I applaud what's been done. Clearly, there may be some instances where there's some stations that, some escalators here that were not prone to be down or out, as you say, but there are also some places here where, as it was indicated, the cost of rehabilitation, both short-term and long-term, can be offset by the savings. I'm not sure what impact this has on accessibility and comfort for our riders. I would also suggest that our riders don't want anything changed. They would like us to continue to pay for everything that would make them happy. We may not be in position to always do that. We have to make tough choices sometimes to make sure that the system operates for everybody in the most expedient way. So I applaud what was done, and I support some additional analysis. And I would like to get some comments from the Riders Advisory Committee and from the public, as was suggested, before we and the board here conclude that this is not a good idea, but get some more input from others who I think would be very conscious of how this impacts the riders.
Well, Marcel, you had a comment.
Yeah, for one, I agree with Dana and Charlie on this one. I have to disagree with Gordon on his comments. I'm for one who don't think it's a good idea. And I just think that we could spend our time doing something else. Because we don't have a lot of time, so let's use it wisely.
Well, it's interesting. Everybody's made some comments. I would think that my comment maybe to take a look at even shorter distances, which might be more acceptable. And I see, and I think this was wise that you went with those that are about to be rehabilitated, because I'll mention, too, that I think I'd love to see switched. That my regular rider that gets off at the Police Memorial or Metro Center, and I have to try to pick which train I get on, because if I get off at the wrong train, instead of going right up the escalator because it's coming down, I have to walk by the narrowness and squeeze around the turn to go up. And if there was just a stairwell, it doesn't matter whether you're going up or down. There are other benefits to putting some stairs in. But I think, you know, this height is a little bit high for me. I mean, I certainly, if I was going to go up one flight of stairs, I would take a stair rather than an escalator a lot. Maybe we could take an 18-foot. Maybe you come back and tell us what it would cost on 18 feet. I know that would take more time, but there might be other reasons that we could reprioritize these based on where are we doing rehab, how much height is involved, and maybe we do a much smaller implementation. But I realize any delay might mean that decisions are made because you're doing the rehab. So I agree, Dana. I think I applaud you for bringing the hard stuff to us. Maybe we can narrow this down with a much smaller focus where it's a bigger impact on dollars saved. Otherwise, I think it's not going to be that popular with the board. Kathy, another comment?
I just wanted to add to that for the clarity of what my point is. When I talk about who will use it, I think we have a growing ridership, I hope, a senior population, a traveling population rather than a commuting population. The number of people who travel with objects more and more every day. Will we have enough capacity on escalators and elevators to accommodate all of that population when we move some of those to stairs? And I that's just a piece of the analysis I think would be good to think about, because in some places it is difficult to choose a stairwell, even if you fit and everything else, because of the conditions at the time. And maybe I just travel in a mode where I see so many people with obstacles, and stairs are not the most accommodating piece for that. So that the analysis kind of points in as much as possible as we look at the growing ridership and how that ridership differs over time as well as in certain places.
Well, I think it's probably, yes, Dana.
Just one other request. I noticed that, if I'm correct here, 7 of these escalators fall in Arlington. And if you haven't heard from Mr. Zimmerman, I ask that you be sure and you know, reach out to him between now and when this comes before the board.
Well, before we move on, last thing I'll make is I, for one, this, and I think Danny made this comment, applaud you for this type of thinking. And even though this one might not be one where everybody was thrilled with, this is the type of creative and bold thinking that I think is most imperative that we continue to have in a general manager. So can we move on then to the next item of business, which is going to be the signage?
Okay, Mr. Costa is going to bring us this. Last month, after last month's committee meeting, Mr. Graham asked us, highlighted to us our problem that we continually have with signage at our elevators and escalators when they are out, and discussion about what our existing policies, procedures are. Dave spent a few minutes going through this with you. Mr. Graham isn't here today. We will bring him through this item before the board meeting, but it'd be helpful for all of you to tell you where we are. It is our Achilles heel. It's not perfect. We need to do better, but these are our procedures. Dave?
Okay, as you know, we operate 588 escalators and 263 elevators in our transit system, and as with any mechanical piece of equipment, they do break down. When an elevator or escalator breaks down, we have a few different modes of getting that information to our passengers. Whenever there's an elevator outage, the outage is listed on our PIDS displays. At the station entrances, elevator and escalator outage information is also available through the Metro Opens Doors website. And additionally, customers may subscribe to email notifications for elevator outages. In addition to those notices, when an elevator or escalator is out of service, signs are posted at the top and bottom of the units, and these signs include an explanation of the work and a projected return to service date. In addition, we also post, in some circumstances, additional signs, for instance, on the platform to provide advance notice to customers before they get to an escalator that's out of service. For instance, at Judy Square, if the entrance escalators are out, well, they'll put signs up on the platform so you can take the elevator up instead of finding out when after you've gone through the fare gates that the escalators aren't working. We also have two station standard operating procedures in place that cover the topics of SSOP number 7 covers elevators, and section 7.5 and 7.6 cover the topics of signage. SSOP number 9 covers escalators, and in that, section 9.9 covers signage. Essentially what they say is when a unit is out of service, there needs to be a sign. If an elevator or escalator journeyman removes a sign, a unit from service, they're responsible to put up the sign and the signs and include the return to service date. If the unit breaks down, the station manager is responsible to put up the signs, at least to notify the people that the unit is out of service. When it's determined by the journeyman, if the journeyman can put it back into service, the sign just comes down. If they're unable to put it into service, they need to update that sign with a projected return to service date. During a long-term outage, we use a different type of sign, but again, it's the journeyman's responsibility to put those signs up and maintain the date. Unfortunately, with all these things in place, we still have problems with our signs, and improvements are needed. We're missing signs and sign holders in a few of our stations. The biggest problem, the one that causes the most trouble, I believe, is there's delays in getting the signs posted and delays in putting the correct return to service dates on the signs. And we're currently working to improve those. We're buying additional signs and sign holders. We're looking at ways to put the same type of signs and sign holders that are available at our escalators permanently at our elevators, so we don't need, the signs will be there and be available when needed. And we've again gone back to our station managers with instructions to post the signs immediately, and additionally to inspect their stations on a periodic basis and checking the running status of the equipment and the sign status is part of those requirements. In addition, when our mechanics check in with our elevator operations center, my dispatchers kind of give them reminders by asking the question when the ticket is open. They ask the question that, you know, are signs posted, which if it's been forgotten, that kind of cuts that off. Again, I guess funding impact, there is no funding impact here. All of the funds required to purchase and maintain the signs are currently included in the operating budget. Does anybody have any questions?
Yes, Gordon does.
Thank you for the information. There's one question I had, though, and as, I guess as we all have our own experiences as we're traveling the system, but I had an incident where, in fact, the elevator was not working because elevators were out for repair. We were doing rehab at the Rockville station. The escalator was out for was under repair. And at the same time, the elevator wasn't working. And that happened. So I went to the station manager and said, you know, what's going on here? We got people who can't go up the escalator, but the elevator's out. And I said, you know, what's the case here and how long this is going to be? And she said, I don't know. She said, I've asked, but I haven't gotten the information. And so that bothered me that she could not even tell the customers, you know, what the situation is, how long the outage would be, and when it will be back up in service. So we need, if we don't have a mechanism where at least the station manager has some inside information on what's going on, what the possible time period is going to be out of service and when it will be back in service.
Is there any response or?
Yeah, we can. If I'm not sure that they know this, but the information is out there and it is available. If they ever need to know specific outage information, it's out there. I'm sorry. It's included in the station operating procedures. The number for the elevator escalator operations center where they could call.
No, she says she has called and didn't get the information.
Okay, I would have who she called.
I mean, I went there already. I called and I couldn't get the information as to when it's going to be back up in operation. She volunteered that information.
Okay, well, again, I'm curious who she called, if she called my operations center or someone else. We won't know that. The only explanation I could say is if the elevator had just gone out of service, there is a possibility that, you know, we wouldn't know when it was going to go back into service until we had a journeyman out there to look at it, and perhaps it went into service, you know, shortly after that. I don't know.
It is a somewhat imprecise science. The technician will come out and troubleshoot and try to guess what the problem is. but then they'll try to work on the problem, and they'll have a guess at how long it's going to take them to fix the problem. They may find an entirely different problem. And so that there is, other than what you discussed, and clearly there should be some estimate. There's always an estimate.
Yeah, I'm not asking for, you know, a rocket science.
Right.
I would, as a customer, and I walk up to the to our customer service manager at station manager and say, the elevator's out. And she can say, yes, we know, and we think it'll be back in service in a day or two, something, but
right.
not.
Absolutely.
That's all. That's
at least
all.
A response, actually, Mr. Diggins next,
okay.
At least a response that it's just happened, or I've got a call in, or I don't have that information now, but we're working on it, instead of I don't know and I put a call. That doesn't exude right. any confidence in our system. But Mr. Deegan, and then the Chairwoman Gladys, yes.
I just wanted to commend you on being honest enough to say that, you know, it's placing the signs isn't exact science. It's not working perfectly because I, like Gordon, was at the College Park Station on the west side Tuesday, and the gate was up. There was no sign. But, as Dan was mentioning, these things happen like that. Sometimes they can be fixed very quickly.
Right.
You know, I understand that. But it's important, I think, when we're doing preventive maintenance, and I've said this before, that we put the signs up so people know that things are going to be out for the day or whatever, and then, of course, the longer-term ones as well. The quick fixes, I don't know if you'll ever be able to correct that, because we're focusing on fixing it right away and not, you know, worried about, well, if I can get it fixed in 10 minutes, what, you know, go through putting the sign up the gate and all that kind of stuff. And just wanted to say I appreciate you being
well, thank you.
Forthright on that, and I'm looking forward to lighting up the escalators.
Let me comment on what I think I heard. I think you said that there are various areas that have responsibility for putting their signs up. And it may be that we could come up with some sort of way to report outages. Maybe somebody could design a computer program so that all these various offices that are responsible for putting signs up, they could input into a screen that gives the overall information on outages, so that if a station manager needed to know when an escalator was going to be fixed, if he could just go into his computer, look at the information on the screen, and provide it to the customer. I'm sure that could be done. I don't know how difficult it is, but
it's actually already done.
So
why didn't this station manager? Why did that station manager then have to call to and respond that they couldn't get an answer to when the escalator was going to be fixed?
Oh, I can't answer for the station manager. I mean,
but you're saying that the station manager has the information in their computer and they just didn't look?
Yes. I mean, there is a page available on the internet that lists every unit that's out of service. When the unit first goes out of service, there's a formula that automatically programs a 3-day lead time for it to return to service. If we go out there and cannot fix it within those 3 days, the date we can manually program in our projected return to service date. For instance, if it's a rehabilitation project, we'll put the date out at the projected 17 weeks or whatever the case may be. But when a unit gets reported out of service and a ticket is opened in the Maximo system, there is a page on the WMATA intranet that monitors the Maximo system and automatically updates to include that outage on that website.
The Maximo system, though, is pretty new, and the training has been focused mainly on the maintenance staff. The backup system, that information actually is backed up into our, even as far into our trip planner. Now that when you go into the trip planner, your trip plan will actually tell you if there are escalator, elevator outages. But some of this stuff happens, you know, pretty quickly. And some of the station managers either haven't been trained or haven't fully inculcated the training to be as customer service friendly as they can be. So the computer system, the board's already made that investment. That's already happened.
Okay. Okay.
That's
okay.
Come into place. It just hasn't been fully implemented. I don't think people fully realize the tools they have.
Okay.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that's one area where we can get the word out to the station managers.
Yes.
That information's in the computer. All they got to do is look, because I think that would give a lot of confidence to the rider that at least we're on top of it. We know, or if it hasn't gotten in the computer yet, you know, if the, you know, station manager says, you know, that information hasn't been updated yet, but it will be within 24 hours or whatever, I think that would help to just show that we're on top of things. One of the issues that Mr. Graham has complained about over and over again is the fact that we do have signs and they say that things will be done by a certain time, and that time is come and gone, and there and the repair of whatever it is has not been done. So I think the other side of this is that we want to make sure that we are monitoring our end dates to make sure that if something happens and we can't complete it by a projected date, that we change the projection. I mean, that has been a constant complaint that I've heard from him. So do we have a mechanism to do that? Or, I mean, again, it seems that if we're working off of data that's available electronically, we just look in and see, you know, it's a simple thing to see when the date was projected and whether it's been done or not, and just to update it, which then would trigger some action to make sure that the public sees a change date.
Well, the current policy right now includes that the station managers, when they check their stations, look at whether or not the equipment is operating, whether or not there's a sign, and whether or not the date has expired on the sign. We also, at least with our rehab projects, have now begun to look at that end date, and if there's a problem at the end of the rehab where there was additional work, unforeseen conditions, or a delay in getting the unit inspected because the jurisdictional authority was tied up or something like that, we look at those dates and we'll change them.
Well, it sounds to me like we really ought to empower the station managers, and as Dan said, make sure they get the training, because in many, many instances, they are the face of WMATA, and they really need to be informed as to the resources that they have available that they can provide to the customer.
Right. I think that's the real point. It's not just empowering them, but you know, increasing their level of responsibility and ownership for the manager side of station manager. And getting a sense, you know, and really knowing the lay of the land. I would say that the majority of the ones I've met actually do have a sense of ownership and responsibility for their station. They do hunt down these issues and try to figure it out, because they don't want to say, I don't know, to a customer.
Yes.
But there are a lot, there's still enough out there that there are, you know, there's plenty of room for additional work on improving that overall customer experience and getting that stronger sense of manager in the station manager title.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any other business for the committee? Thank you for, I'm sorry. Yes, there is.
No, there's not.
No. Okay, I know we have another committee meeting, and
we'll begin immediately.
Okay. You want to start up? Thank you.